It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is off today. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear from a founding member of the legendary Milwaukee band Violent Femmes about their early years and the staying power of their music. First, additional American troops appear to be heading to Iraq as the extremist group known as the Islamic State continues to take cities around the country. Earlier this week, President Obama authorized the deployment of up to 450 more American troops to Iraq in order to train and assist the Iraqi forces who are battling ISIS. Now, a top American general is saying the U.S. is considering establishing additional military bases there in Iraq. All this has some people wondering, what exactly are we getting into after a decade of war in Iraq? Are we heading back into another extended conflict there? Joining us now is Jeremy Suri. He's the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs and Professor of History and Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. Jeremy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So more military advisors headed over to Iraq to help with training, a lot of news, maybe more bases. How did we get back to this point after this long drawdown in Iraq?
Well, we're in a vicious cycle, unfortunately. We've tried to withdraw from the region. That was a serious plan, which President Barack Obama was pursuing. But the destruction in the region, the collapse of the Iraqi state, and the somewhat full collapse of the Syrian state have allowed new terrorist groups, new groups that we see as threats to our interests, to come into power in various parts of the area. And the concern that they will attack American interests in the region has convinced at least the American military leadership that we need to have more of a military presence. So the consequences of what we did in the early 2000s are pulling us back in right now.
One difficulty here is that we're putting more American interests there potentially to be attacked. There's concern that more American troops, more American bases, more targets for ISIS leading to possible escalation.
I think that's a real and legitimate concern. The more presence we have on the ground, it makes it easier for ISIS and other groups to target us. And in addition, it gives ammunition to their claims that we're invading their territory. These are Sunni Muslims, some of whom are coming from outside the region, but many of whom are from within the region, who see us as attackers on their territory. And the more people we send there, the more ammunition we give to the very people we're fighting.
Now, as President Obama takes this action, he's getting criticized from both sides, from some who don't want any more American involvement than we already have in Iraq. Others from hawks, especially Republicans in places like the U.S. Senate, saying this isn't enough. Trainers aren't enough. We need active troops helping be spotters for airstrikes, maybe more. Is he being pulled in both directions there?
I think, unfortunately, he is. This is the theme of his presidency, especially for foreign policy. Those who wanted us to stay in and be stronger are criticizing us for, as you said, having not stayed as strong as they think we should have been. And others who want us to depart from the region are concerned that we're now re-entering. And we might be getting the worst of both worlds, which is where we send enough forces on the ground to put our name on what's happening there, but not enough to make a difference. And I think the administration has to make some real hard decisions as to whether we're going to disengage, really, and allow bad things to happen, but stay away from it, the region, or whether we want to get in much more fully. And a halfway position is probably not going to work.
Talking to foreign policy expert Jeremy Suri from the University of Texas about the news this week, U.S. sending more troops as advisors to Iraq, considering maybe more U.S. bases there as well. Now, a lot of the talk this week has been about getting Sunni militias, Sunni groups opposed to the Sunni organization ISIS involved in the effort more directly, a concern that the Shia-led government is focusing only on its own troops, as effective as they are, and Shia militias. So how can we bring a coalition crossing that Sunni-Shia boundary to fight ISIS together?
I'm not sure we can. We've been talking about trying to get the quote-unquote good Sunnis to fight on our behalf, quite frankly, since General Petraeus was in the region. And one of the things he did effectively in the short run was appeal to some of those groups. But, of course, that didn't last very long. And we have a horrible track record of managing the factional and ethnic disputes in this region. What generally happens is groups work with us when it's in their short-term interest and then turn against us as soon as they can, especially when they know we're not going to stay in the region for a long time. So I'm skeptical, quite frankly, Rob, of any plan that says we are going to broker an agreement that will bring various Sunni forces together to fight against the extremist Sunnis. I just don't think that's going to work.
It seems like ISIS's success has been this divide and conquer strategy. Multiple sides can't get together. They don't want to risk helping one enemy, in this case Shias versus Sunnis, to attack a common foe, in this case ISIS.
That's right. And I don't think that our getting involved on the ground is going to make this any better, quite frankly. I think the best thing we can do is to try to contain the problem as best we can, and to support those groups which we think are less damaging to us in the short run than ISIS is, but to support them from a distance, maybe using airstrikes when necessary. But sending more trainers and more soldiers on the ground, I actually don't see how that's going to help, for precisely the reason you just said, because it is such a divided and factionalized area.
We'll talk more about how that kind of containment might work to restrict ISIS from spreading within countries like Iraq and Syria and maybe Libya now, and going out to new countries.
Right. So I think one of the things we need to do is to work with the states that are stable states, even if we don't like them, the stable states in the region that can at least bring legitimate power to bear in protecting their borders and perhaps supporting their compatriots in these other societies that have essentially fallen apart. And this is why I strongly support efforts to work with the Iranians. There are many things that the government of Iran does that we don't like, but the government of Iran is similarly opposed to ISIS as we are. And they are a government that is capable of more effectively operating in this territory than we can, and they have a little more legitimacy. So I support the president's efforts to work with Iran as a possible ally. For better or for worse, our allies in the region are going to be the states, not the ethnic groups that we're ignorant of and not capable of really working with effectively.
But working more with Iran, a Shia nation, Shia-led nation, does that drive the moderate Sunnis more into the camp of ISIS if they feel like it's the U.S. and Shia Iran against us?
Well, that would be the case if we worked exclusively with the Iranians. But, of course, we have long-standing ties with the Saudis, which are the opposite side of that coin. I wouldn't call them moderate Sunnis, but they claim to speak for the so-called moderate Sunnis. And what we've traditionally done that has worked to some extent in the region is to balance among the various states, among the Shia and Sunni states, and not be seen as solely supporting one group or another, but instead supporting state structures that are able to protect basic order in the region and prevent just this divide and conquer strategy and the strategy of terror that you've described so well, Rob. And so I think balancing between the Sunnis and the Iranians, between the Saudis and the Iranians and others, is the best thing we can do. And I think that's what the president is trying to do. I'm afraid that sending more American soldiers on the ground will derail us from what is probably a better diplomatic strategy.
Leave it there for now. Jeremy, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Jeremy Suri, professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas, Austin, joining us to talk about the Obama administration's plans against the Islamic State in Iraq. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret, and that's the distinctive sound of the Milwaukee band Violent Femmes. Since forming in 1980, the band continues to be one of Wisconsin's most successful musical groups ever. With a stripped-down sound heard on hits like Add It Up and this one, Blister in the Sun, the trio is considered to be one of the most influential alternative rock bands of the 1980s and 90s. Original members Brian Ritchie and Gordon Gano have gotten the band back together without original drummer Victor DiLorenzo. They're playing a show this weekend in Milwaukee. Joining us now to talk about the band's career is bassist Brian Ritchie. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, you are coming back, playing a show in Wisconsin. You've played all over the world. Is there still something special about coming back home and playing a show here?
Well, you know, considering our long history and how many gigs we've done there, it's always special to come back. And it happens less frequently now, so those points get bigger and bigger than they were in the past, where we might have played. Well, in the early years, we played hundreds of gigs in a year just in Milwaukee, and now we do once a year or once every few years. So that's a big deal.
Well, take us back to those early days before the first album hit it big. What was it like playing around Milwaukee, literally on the sidewalks of Milwaukee?
Well, we were on the sidewalks because the clubs didn't want anything to do with us. They didn't even think that we were not even related to rock music. So their idea of rock and roll was whatever the local bands were doing, which is mainly like kind of boogie music, southern type boogie rock, and you know, it was a very backwards musical scene. So we, you know, we were getting, and even the punk scene didn't really take us too seriously because we were playing acoustic instruments and they thought of us as folk. So we had no identity within the culture, but then we were playing out on the street as a result of being kicked out of a club when we tried to audition. We were so dejected that we went to play for the people waiting in line for the Pretenders concert. And the Pretenders heard us and invited us to open up the show because they loved us. And, you know, that kind of, well, it vindicated us, at least to ourselves, to know that we were on the right track. We knew we were, but it was good to see somebody from the outside of that little swamp, recognizing us.
Well, now, when I listen back to a lot of music in that era, I think, oh, that was okay, but it's very much of that time. You'd never hear that synthesizer patch anywhere else or whatever. Do you think because you played those acoustic instruments, your music had more staying power, as I think it does?
Yes, Rob, and that was actually a conscious decision on our part, which turns out to have been prophetic, you know, since I'm speaking to you now 35 years later. We knew that that stuff wasn't going to last, and we decided intentionally to make recordings and to take a musical direction that was part of the continuum of American music and of rock music, not even just rock, but we also had these strong kind of jazz impulses to improvise and blues and folk and bluegrass music. So we decided intentionally not to do that. In fact, we were offered a record deal from a major label for a lot of money after we made the first album. They said, oh, this is a good demo. Now let's make an album. And they wanted us to put those keyboards, like you mentioned, on there and work with a producer and probably use a drum machine and do all that stuff. And we just said, no, this is the music. This is the way we want to be represented, and we wouldn't back down, which meant that we had to go with an independent label, but in the long term, it also meant that we had some credibility.
Well, tell us about recording that first album, and you recorded it at Castle Studios in Lake Geneva?
Yeah, which was a former Playboy Club, and it was an experience. We drove every day. We slept in the studio. We hardly had any money. We were, you know, financing it ourselves, and you know, back in those days, you just didn't make an album lightly. I mean, now everybody can make it on their Pro Tools unit on their computer in their bedroom. You know, like my friend Gauthier had a, you know, number one hit single all over the world with something that he recorded on a computer in his parents' house or something. So it's a different story than it was then. Back then, going into the studio was a commitment. And we took it pretty seriously, so we planned that album quite a bit beforehand, even down to the point of making the order before we made the album and demoing the entire album. So there's like a facsimile of the album that we did on just a four-track machine. Some of that stuff came out later when we reissued the album in extended form.
And as you said, this was punk, folk, country, jazz, rock influenced. And a lot of times when things cross boundaries, cross categories, nobody ends up getting into it. This is the opposite. This ended up being one of the defining albums of the time. Did you have any idea when you put the wrapper on this that it was going to do so well?
We knew that it was going to be considered a classic by somebody. little did we know that it would be the masses. We thought of ourselves more in line with artists like maybe back in those days, like Television or Patti Smith. You know, at the commercial end of the spectrum, we would have considered ourselves in line with the Ramones, but not even that. So we didn't know that it was going to become so popular. You know, like right now, for example, we're managed by Tom Sarig, who was Lou Reed's manager. And, you know, he points out to us that we sold a lot more records than the Velvet Underground did. So the music we were listening to and aspired to was probably more niche than what we ended up being.
Talking to Brian Ritchie with the Violent Femmes, coming back to Wisconsin for a show this weekend. And Brian, I want to fast forward. I think a lot of your fans were excited to know that you were playing again, doing shows again. Surprised probably to know that you had new music come out. So you got into the studio literally New Year's Eve last year. What got you back into the studio to record after a long hiatus?
It was an odd story. You know, we had an extended period. Well, there were about 12 or 13 years when we didn't record, and when we were together and we didn't record, or we didn't record because we were split up. So even when we were still together, we didn't record for quite some time, and I think it was mainly Gordon had lost his inspiration, or maybe he lost the will to continually put out music that people, you know, would sometimes refer to the first album, or all this isn't as good as the first album. If you actually listen to a lot of our stuff, there's quite a bit of good material there, and I think he got sick of being compared always to the first album. But now he seems to be over it, and he wants to do recording. So I was hesitant to do that because I knew that it could lead to various problems, you know, whether if people don't accept it or if we get disappointed by the response. But now the entire record industry has collapsed, so we're actually right back where we started, which is make the music just because we want to and because we have something to say. And the production on the record is even probably even more primitive than what we did on the first album. It's like even liver than that and even more ambient in the studio, like musicians in a room playing together, similar to a jazz recording. And it's kind of come full circle for us.
One thing that strikes me listening to these, you mentioned, you know, you resisted the urge to, or the imperative to put keyboards and all sorts of fancy stuff over it. But over the years, you've played with horn players, the horns of Dilemma, and there's a lot of great, I'm a sax player, a lot of great bass saxophone going throughout, I think, almost the whole four tracks. So horns did fit the music somehow.
Well, that's because we're really into the blues and jazz mentality. We, as listeners, we listen more to jazz probably than anything else. So to us, a saxophone is not like an exotic instrument. Like some people think when they listen to, for example, the Bruce Springsteen or Roxy Music, you know, the rare bands that had a saxophone player, that, oh, wow, that sax is an exotic instrument. For us, it's an everyday thing, and we love the saxophone. That guy who's playing on the recording, Blaze Garza, he's 25 years old. He's been playing with us since he was 14, and he was a fan of ours since he was about 9, and now we also have a new drummer, Brian Viglione, who was with Dresden Dolls, who were heavily influenced by us. So we've got this interesting kind of dynamic going where we've got young people coming into the band, but they're not coming into the band like, oh, let's go find some talented young people to make ourselves sound good. It's more like they're fans. They really understand the music because they've been listening to it for their whole life, you know, and when they come into the band and play with us, they know exactly how it's supposed to be because they're actually deep fans.
Now, for the band, you've had ups and downs, you and Gordon, breakups, a lawsuit in there somewhere. When you get back together and play, is it just a, you know, magical, oh, all that's behind us and we're playing music again? Or does it take some work to get into that zone where you can make music together again?
Well, when we got back together for Coachella, it was pretty comfortable for me and Gordon. We just picked up not where we left off, but, you know, in a better space than where we left off because we wanted to do it. So, and the music is very natural. I mean, that's one of the good things about having this kind of rough approach that we have. It doesn't require a huge amount of rehearsal nor planning nor arguing about what it's supposed to sound like. We know what it's supposed to sound like, and we just go for it, and we get there very quickly. So the music is always easy. You know, it's best when everybody as individuals are in a good frame of mind and healthy and positive. So that's where Gordon and I found ourselves when we got back together again.
So you're touring. You have this new four-song release. Any more recordings coming up?
In fact, we recorded a bunch of songs in Brooklyn, and we also have been recording in Milwaukee. And we've got about nine of them in the can right now. So we brought along recording gear on the tour, and we'll find some time on the tour to record, maybe in the bus or hotel room or something, and finish out the album and probably have it out early next year.
All right, Brian, have a great return show to Milwaukee, and good luck with the new album.
Really looking forward to it. Thanks, Rob.
That was Brian Ritchie, bassist for Violent Femmes. You can catch them live this Saturday at the BMO Harris Pavilion in Milwaukee. Coming up, we'll learn about the benefits of reading, the maybe psychological benefits of reading, from one of the world's first bibliotherapists. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is off today. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Close to me, she mean all the world. But then she like another guy. I fall down dead, she never see the tears I cry.
For centuries, people have turned to books during rough times, seeking some kind of therapeutic benefits from their reading. Now those benefits are being rolled into a new field, a new concept called bibliotherapy. Here to talk about bibliotherapy and the benefits of reading is Ella Bertu. She's credited as being one of the world's first bibliotherapists. She's also the co-author of the book The Novel Cure, From Abandonment to Zestlessness, 751 Books to Cure What Ails You. Ella, thanks for joining us today.
Hello, Rob. Great to meet you.
So what exactly, give us the basic concept. What is bibliotherapy?
Bibliotherapy is the art of curing life's ailments through using fiction. So we meet a client, we send them a questionnaire in advance, and we get to know them through the questionnaire. We then talk to them for about 45 minutes, which is a bit like having an ordinary kind of psychotherapy session, but we're talking about books, and we get to know their life issues and also their reading loves and hates and dislikes and what makes them tick as a reader. And at the end of that session, we go away and think for a little bit, and then we prescribe them books, which will be their perfect reads, which will not only entertain them, but also help them through any problems that they're having at this juncture in their lives.
So what is it about fiction that can have that kind of power in our lives?
We feel that fiction can be a completely transformative experience, because by immersing yourself in a book, you become as one with the characters in the book and also the sensibilities of the author, overcome your own feelings, and you can effectively live the lives of the characters within the book, which can actually make you experience a metamorphosis yourself. So sometimes fiction can completely change your character, and actually if you read the right book at the right time in your life, we do feel that it can be incredibly positive and help you to form your moral character. There's a lot of amazing books that people read in their childhood which are responsible for the way that they feel about things later in life. For instance, To Kill a Mockingbird is a book which has had a huge effect on a lot of people in the way that they see justice. And we could name hundreds of books. I'm sure, Rob, you've had the same experience in your reading life. There are books that effectively make you the person that you are today.
Now
would you say that's true of yourself?
I think so. And if your next question is which ones, let me ponder that for a bit, and I'll maybe come up with a couple. But I wanted to ask, you and your co-author of The Novel Cure had been prescribing each other books for a while. How did you two start with this concept of coming up with books for each other to help each other through difficult periods of your lives?
Well, Susan Alderkin, my co-author, was at Cambridge University with me, and she actually lived in the next door room, and that's how we met each other. And we got to know each other quite slowly, but the process whereby we got to know each other was by noticing that the other one was feeling a bit down about something. So it might be to do with a relationship, a broken heart, or even something as slightly mundane as not being able to give in an essay. And when we realized that the other one was having this crisis, we would give each other a book. We would just sort of gently pop it under each other's doors late at night, and then we'd find this book the next morning. And we became very good at knowing what was bugging each other and giving each other the right book at the right time. So, for instance, Suze really wanted to be a writer, and you'll be glad to hear she did become a novelist and has successfully written two fantastic novels. And when she was having a crisis about that, thinking, I'm never going to be able to make any money, how am I going to work as a novelist and get on with the rest of my life, I gave her the fantastic book, I don't know if you know it, called Archie and Mehita Bell by Don Marquis, which is, he's a poet, Don Marquis, who used to work, he's a real man that used to work in the New Yorker offices. And in this book, he is pretending to be a cockroach who's writing poems in the middle of the night in the New Yorker offices. And the cockroach has the soul of a bard, and he is desperate to get down his words. And the point of me giving that book to Suze was that if Archie the cockroach can write this amazing poetry by headbutting the keys of a typewriter, because that's the only way that he can write his poetry, because he's a cockroach, then, Suze, you can actually do the same effectively by going all out to write your novel and not caring about the rest of the world. And if you believe in it enough, then it will work. And that's what happened.
That did the trick? She didn't gripe about the comparison between her and a cockroach?
Luckily not. She saw to the soul of the poetry.
Excellent.
And she found it funny.
Now, you are the first practicing bibliotherapist, as I understand it, but this concept has been with us, I don't know how far back, this idea that there's some power in fiction that can shape our lives, change our lives, hopefully for the better.
It goes back to the time of Aristotle, when there was actually a library that had words carved above its entrance saying, this is a place of healing in Greek. And people realized even then that books had the power to heal. So that's 1,000 years ago that people were realizing that by reading you could be healed. And it's carried on, it's still been acknowledged over the years. In the Second World War, doctors occasionally gave their patients who were soldiers who'd been to the war and been shell-shocked, they were given the novels of Jane Austen, which I wouldn't necessarily say are the best cures, but the reason they were giving them those books was to try and sort of calm them down and use bibliotherapy as a way of addressing their disconnectedness with their present world, having been to the war. And actually, bibliotherapy has also been used over the last 50 years for children who've been having difficulties for various reasons, whether it's abusive parents or poverty or being dislocated from their homes. And they've been given bibliotherapy as well in various different ways. But the way that we do our bibliotherapy service is something quite new.
Talking to Ella Bertu about the concept of bibliotherapy, the idea that we can find in fiction the cure for what ails us in some cases, maybe not for a broken bone, but maybe for the trauma of having broken a bone. Well, let's talk about some specific recommendations, Ella. You mentioned, these efforts in World War II, maybe Jane Austen, not the best. But if someone came and said, I've been through a traumatic experience, maybe at wartime, what kind of books might you point them toward?
Yes. Well, actually, I haven't been asked that question before about wartime experiences, but that is a very interesting question. We do have the thing is, it so much depends on the kind of person that you are and what you like to read anyway. So whenever we meet a bibliotherapy client who have either been referred to us or come of their own accord or been given bibliotherapy as a gift. We have to take into account very much what kind of person they are, what kind of reader they have been before. So if we are to meet a soldier who's been through great traumas in the war, we would first need to know, does he actually like reading detective fiction, crime fiction, science fiction, literary fiction, before we can give him his prescription. But there are, we have got, having said that, various generic cures which we find very helpful. So one of our best cures for stress is a really lovely book called The Man Who Planted Trees by John Giorno, which is a kind of fable about a man who literally goes around his area of countryside, which has been devastated by war, and he plants acorns, which then grow into a forest. And it's a very short, beautiful book, but it is one of those books which is extremely healing and redemptive. So that's the kind of book that we would look at. But then we also might consider giving our shell-shocked soldier something that's a very escapist book, or a book like The Kite Runner by Khaled Husseini, which shows you the other side of the Afghanistan war, so what it's like for the people, the indigenous people that were there. So we always have to be very careful to make sure our prescription is completely unique to the person.
We're talking to bibliotherapist Ella Bertu about the benefits of reading, her book recommendations, the use of fiction to get through difficult patches of our lives. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you ever had this happen to you? Have you ever used a book to get through a hard time, a turning point in your life maybe? Is there a fiction book in particular that helped you make a decision, gotten you through that rough patch? What books do you read when you're feeling lonely, scattered, sad, angry? Which books do you recommend to someone else in that situation? Call in with your experiences and your recommendations at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our conversation now about bibliotherapy, the benefits of reading, reading fiction in particular, with Ella Bertu. She's credited as being one of the first bibliotherapists, and she's the co-author of the book The Novel Cure, From Abandonment to Zestlessness, 751 Books to Cure What Ails You. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you turn to fiction for some form of solace, for healing? Do you need certain books or kinds of books for a different mood, a situation in your life? Give us a specific recommendation on a book that helped you in some way, a fiction book. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to a caller. We've got Katie on the line in Hartford. Katie, hi.
I wanted to recommend a book. It's not fiction, it's memoir, but it's called Half a Life. And for me, it was particularly healing. I dealt with a loss of a cousin who died in a bike accident. And the story is about a man who at age, I think he was 16, accidentally killed a young woman who was biking. And he spent the rest of his life just sort of dealing with that.
And Katie, who's the author of that?
You know, I don't recall.
Okay, but Half a Life is the title.
Half a Life, yes.
And that, you feel like it helped you through that rough period?
Yes, definitely. I think anybody who's dealing with any kind of guilt or even just loss, I think this book would help.
Katie, thank you so much for that suggestion. Ella, I imagine this is something that comes up a fair amount, people dealing with loss of some sort or another. Do you have books that you've recommended to people in the past?
Very much so, yes. And we do prescribe memoir as well occasionally, but we have a good range of novels that we give to people when they are bereaved. And of course, there's so many different kinds of bereavements that we do have many different books for each client. But one of our favorites is After You'd Gone by Maggie O'Farrell, who's a British author. And she writes very movingly about the death of a fictional husband, and that is a very cathartic book. Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close by Jonathan Safran Foer is one of the books that we often recommend, because that was a book about the Twin Towers and the bereavement of a boy whose father died in that tragedy. Also, Siri Hustvedt's book, What I Loved, which is another novel, is about the death of a child. And that's a book which is extremely painful to read, but also is one which any bereaved person can massively relate to the experiences that the characters are going through. And many of our clients have found that book a very helpful book to read in times of bereavement. And yes, that is one of the big things that people come to us for bibliotherapy sessions. It's often a case that they come to us at times of crisis in their lives, and the death of a loved one is one of those moments.
Katie, thanks for that call. Galen, our producer, by the way, lets us know Half Life is by Darren Strauss. Grew up out of a This American Life episode, a public radio show, This American Life. I'll go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. We've got Catherine on the line with us now in Madison. Catherine, hi.
Hi.
What book did you want to bring up?
I wanted to bring up Bridge Across Forever by Richard Bach. I received the book from a gentleman in Atlanta with a note in the front of it that he hoped it would help me make my decision. This was about a marriage proposal. And I, the more I read the book, the more I was sure that I had picked the right guy, not him, but someone else. And so I gave the book, I forgot about the inscription in it, and gave the book to the other guy.
Wow, that's a great story.
Who had already proposed and moved our marriage date up after the inscription.
Wow. Okay. So the hopefully this was good outcome here. The marriage worked out, Catherine?
It was the best.
Oh, wonderful. Good. I wanted to make sure we had a happy ending there. Thank you, Catherine. So that's another thing I wonder about. People with a decision to make, whether it's yes to that proposal, yes to moving to a new country, yes to a new job. Are there good books you've recommended for turning points? What do I do now, Ella?
Yes, that's a great question, too. One of our books that we often recommend for turning points is by Saul Bellow, and it's called Henderson, the Rain King. I don't know if you know that.
I've heard of it, haven't read it.
Yeah, it's a great, fantastic, sprawling novel about a man who goes to Africa in search of himself. And all sorts of crazy things happen to him on his adventures. But it is one of those books which you live through all these enormous events in this man's life, and you feel very much better able to make your own decisions by the end of it. But it's a kind of magical book that you can't quite explain. Also, R.K. Narayan, who's a really fantastic Indian author, wrote a really lovely book called The Guide, which is about a man who starts off as a tourist guide and goes through many different careers until he becomes a spiritual guide. And it's a very wise, beautifully written, and very short book, which is an easy read. And that's one of those books which we give to people when they're going through these kind of turning points, too.
Talking about the power of fiction, the healing power of fiction, with Ella Bertou, a bibliotherapist. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234 with Terry in Oconomowoc. Terry, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. My first year of teaching was in Los Angeles, and it was the year of the riots, which really shook me to the bone. And I remember at our back-to-school night, we actually was open house night. We had to, you know, be in before sundown. And for the next 2 years, I read nothing but African-American literature. And I know you're talking a lot about fiction. One of them was The Power of One, which is about South Africa. But I also dug into a lot of nonfiction. The autobiographies of MLK and Malcolm X makes me want to holler. I read W.E.B. Du Bois, The Soul of Black Folk, and it just opened up another world to me and helped me make sense of what had just happened. And I still refer to it because of what's going on now around the country.
Terry, wow. Great story. And Ella reading for understanding in what must have been a confusing time, especially to be that close to that historic rioting and restlessness in Los Angeles.
Absolutely. Well, we think that reading is very much about the desire to discover more about the world. And often one of their main reasons to read fiction and nonfiction is to find out more about your own part of the world and other people's cultures. So we very frequently recommend books for people who are visiting other cultures, trying to understand their own culture. Historical fiction can be really great for that. Also, people clearly read a lot of non-fiction, which is about the history of their own countries. But we do tend to veer towards fiction because we feel that authors really can get under the skin of the characters and hook you in a way that you don't necessarily get so hooked in by non-fiction. But it all depends on the reader. Some people much prefer to read non-fiction.
Ella, briefly, as we're almost out of time, what are you reading right now?
I'm reading a huge number of children's books at the moment.
Fantastic.
Because we're writing the follow-up to the novel Cure, which is going to be called A Spoonful of Stories, which is a kind of novel cure for kids. So the idea is that parents can look up ailments that their children have, from anything from bullying to moving house, moving country, parents getting divorced, etc., and find the perfect books for their kids to read. So I'm having a great time reading everything from Divergent to Little House on the Prairie.
Well, Ella, I look forward to talking to you about that. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Great to talk to you.
That's Ella Bertu, bibliotherapist, co-author of the book The Novel Cure.